final lecture is going to deal with some of the effects of radiation outside of the clinic primarily. It deals with radiation risk and the assessment of risk. It's particularly important for radiation oncologists too, because they are frequently put in positions where they have to opine upon what kind of risk is associated with radiation exposure. As I've already said, the history of radiation is a long one. It's interesting to realize that there was, in the early days, a craze for radiation. It was thought to be a miracle cure that was going to revolutionize society. One sees the development of radioactive drinks like Radiothor, which was guaranteed to contain at least one microcurie of radium. It's used for the treatment of joint and muscular conditions, high blood pressure, nephritis, anemia. There were people who used to drink this on a very regular basis. One of these, a millionaire called Byers, consumed it and died several years later with no teeth and bone necrosis. In spite of really obvious harmful effects of radiation, radiation was seen to be a major societal event. The idea of being able to see through the wondrous X-rays, through sheets of steel, through a block of wood, was thought to be quite remarkable. It was thought to be very good for your health. So Joachim Stahl, where Marie Curie obtained her pitch blend to isolate radium from, was really a spa town. Where people used to go to take the radium baths. It's also the town where uranium miners in the 1950s and 60s developed a very high incidence of lung cancer. And so in all aspects of society, radium and radioactivity in general was seen to be of medicinal and societal benefit. This is in spite of the fact that Edison had warned in 1896 about the danger of eye injuries from X-rays, and one of his workers actually died in 1904 and he stopped working with radioactivity. There were arthritis patients who were dying as a result of radium injection, and it was obvious from the hands of technicians and their clinical outcome that radiation has some very bad effects. This of course led to the first standards for radiation exposure being introduced in 1921, and nowadays radiation is the most regulated substance that we work with anywhere. One of the major kind of realizations that radiation could be bad for you came from what happened to the Radium Girls. The Radium Girls painted the dials of altimeters which were used by fighter pilots, and these dials, in order to become luminous, had to be painted using brushes, and the girls used to lick the brushes to get a nice fine point. Their hair, hands, arms, necks, dresses all became luminous as a result, and unfortunately a number of these girls fell ill. The US Radium Corporation, although they were familiar with the effects of radium, didn't actually tell the workers of the dangers. And it wasn't until a health worker called Alice Hamilton got involved and attracted the attention of Walt Lippmann, a very famous New York journalist, who made his name actually on this case, that the publicity was brought to the attention of the public. Five girls sued the U.S. Radium Company, who died, denied any knowledge of health hazards. The case was settled out of court for $10,000 and $600 a year while they lived. Unfortunately, they were all dead 2 years later. The other major consequence was, of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It became clear that although the bomb had killed about 90 to 140,000 people in Hiroshima and obliterated more than 4 square miles, and 60 to 80,000 in Nagasaki, the real psychological impact of the bomb has been in terms of radiation-induced cancers. Nowadays, we are assailed by the possibility of terrorists use of radioisotopes, and also, of course, the possibility of accidental exposures as a result of power stations, primarily. These exposures may be partial or whole body. Contamination may be internal or surface. There are many, many confounding variables involved. But it's certainly true that at least the US government and many other governments are putting more money into radiobiology as a result of this threat than they have for many, many decades. It's important, I think, to realize that in a situation or where a bomb goes off in particular, the extent of damage caused by ionization per se is much less than what would be caused as by the blast and the ground shock or by the thermal radiation. The initial response to radiation has been well worked out. This is in part, of course, because of the number of accidents that have occurred, what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and also what happens to bone marrow transplant patients. There's a prodromal phase, which normally develops within a couple of days, which may take up to 6 days. The symptoms really depend upon the dose rate, and many host factors. But the earlier the onset of symptoms, the higher the dose, the worse is the prognosis. This prodromal phase results in nausea, vomiting, then diarrhea, with anorexia developing as well. Supportive care is important because of fluid loss and the possibility of infection. So antibiotics are normally given in large quantities at this phase. At later phase, over the period of 3 to 10 days, infection becomes a major issue. On later time points, the acute radiation syndrome depends upon the dose. There are 4 systems primarily involved: the hematopoietic, cutaneous, GI, and neurovascular systems. The hematopoietic damage occurs with doses greater than 1 gray, with an LD50 within 2 months of 2.5 to 5 gray. Death typically occurs within 2 weeks to 2 months. In contrast, the gastrointestinal symptoms occur at greater than 6 gray. The LD100 is about 10 gray, and death is much more rapid, occurring within days to weeks after exposure. One of the best indicators of dose still is the lymphocyte counts in the peripheral blood. And Essentially, these will fall fairly dramatically within 1 to 2 days after radiation, and will decrease to less than 5% of normal if, in fact, a lethal dose has been given. Relative intrinsic radiation sensitivity of different T cell subsets actually varies. And activated lymphocytes can in fact be radiation resistant. The other thing that one sees following whole body exposure, white cells after the initial drop can actually recover again. The recovery takes place with about 2 weeks after radiation. And again, is fairly dose dependent. It tends to actually take place rather more rapidly. If the dose is higher than if it's lower. The acute radiation syndrome is a deterministic event following radiation. In other words, it increases in severity with dose. On the other hand, there are many stochastic effects of radiation, which are governed more by random chance, and the probability of an occurrence increases with dose. For example, radiation carcinogenesis. So the high dose effects are that are deterministic primarily involve tissue or organ failure and are related to cell killing, whereas the low dose effects are mutations, carcinogenesis, and in utero effects. The stochastic effects of radiation are important in the field of health physics and radiation protection. Here we tend to use sieverts, the unit of equivalent dose, rather than gray, because of the differences in quality of different types of radiation. So the sievert is a product of the absorbed dose in gray and the quality factor Q, or the weighting factors which take into account differences in biological effectiveness of different types of radiations. For low LET gamma and X-rays, the weighting factor or the quality factor is 1. In other words, 1 sievert is equal to 1 gray. Another unit that is used is the rem, and 1 sievert is equal to 100 rem. In other words, for low LET radiation, 1 rem and centigray are the same. Radiation weighting factors are somewhat arbitrary. They are obviously worked out largely from the relative biological effectiveness of different types of radiation. So for alpha particles, they are in the order of 20. Neutrons is going to be determined by the LET of the type of neutron which is being used. In addition, there are tissue weighting factors that are often taken into account. This evaluates the relative contribution of that particular tissue to the effects of whole body radiation. So for bone marrow, breast, colon, lung, the tissue weighting factor is 0.12, whereas for things like bone and kidney, it's considerably less. Of course, whenever we're talking about low-dose radiation effects, it's important to define what we mean by a low dose. Essentially, we tend to think of background radiation as being 2.5 millisieverts per year. This, of course, will depend very much upon where one is. In any event, radon is the major contributor of radiation exposure in the environment. Medical sources, however, take up a considerable part of the pie, with varying levels of exposure depending upon the type of manipulation which this patient's undergone. If one looks at the level of background radiation in different countries, it varies enormously. So, for example, in Finland, have over three times as much exposure as we have in the United States. This is largely due to the differences in the effects of in the amount of radon in the ground. Willow was the first to show that X-rays were mutagenic, and this has been a focus of very much research over the years. It was particularly important in the immediate post-war era, where an enormous amount of research funding was put into trying to determine the mutagenic effects of radiation exposure. And in general, mutations can either be classified as being somatic or germline. Spontaneous mutations obviously occur within DNA, and these are often point mutations, deletions, insertions, duplications, and so on. Radiation-induced mutations are essentially the same spectrum of effects. However, most of them, in fact, are deletions. What is clear, however, is radiation is a universal carcinogen that penetrates cells and tissues and can cause mutational events. Unfortunately, there is no strong evidence for a footprint, a genetic footprint of radiation exposure, which would be very valuable if one wanted to identify whether a mutation was radiation induced or not. As far as the genetic effects of radiation are concerned, most likely there is no dose threshold, and that mutations will accumulate with increasing dose. High doses, the cytotoxic effects of radiation will limit the number of mutations that will occur. Most detectable mutations are going to be recessive, and dominant mutations will result normally in death. The way one assesses the effects of radiation on mutations is by the mutation doubling dose. In other words, the dose that doubles the spontaneous mutation rate. This is generally taken to be an estimate of the genetic risks of radiation exposure and is generally considered to be about 1 sievert for low dose rate exposure. This is based upon mouse data and also on human data from the A-bomb survivors, which really showed no significant effect as far as that we could judge. However, the effects that did exist do not contradict the estimate of 1 sievert as the mutation doubling dose. The mouse experiments were primarily done by Russell and Russell at Oak Ridge in the post-war era. What happened was the male and female mice were irradiated with various doses, dose rates, and fractionation schemes. And the coat color was taken as the endpoint, but skeletal and other abnormalities were also included. This is often known as the Mega Mouse Project because of the many tens of thousands of animals which were involved. What he showed was the mutation doubling dose actually varies for different mutations. There is a dose rate effect. The males are more sensitive than the females. And the time between radiation and fertilization is very important in terms of the extent of to which the genetic effects of radiation manifest themselves. This is also true in humans, and in general, a period of 6 months between irradiation and conception is normally used in genetic counseling in humans exposed to radiation. The reason for this long time period, of course, is the long time period that it takes for sperms to be generated from spermatogonia. Somatic mutations following radiation can be assessed in a number of different ways. Experimentally, the most common assay is the HPRT assay. This is a way of measuring somatic mutations, which is primarily uses lymphocytes as a cell source. It's based upon the fact that hypoxanthine, guanine, ribosyl transferase ribophosphorylates both hypoxanthine and guanine. However, it also phosphorylates the cytotoxic purine analog 6-thioguanine. And whenever this gets phosphorylated, it is toxic. Since this enzyme activity is dispensable for viability, mutated cells and or cells which have mutated this enzyme will grow in the presence of 6-thioguanine. So one can irradiate cells and look for their ability to grow in the presence of this drug. And again, using this assay, the mutation doubling dose is thought to be in the order of 1 gray or 1 sievert. A more direct way of looking at the effects of radiation in terms of carcinogenesis is to study radiation-induced transformation. This model is thought to mimic the initiation and promotion steps of carcinogenesis. One takes fairly normal cells, which will form a confluent monolayer in a petri dish, irradiate them, and wait for 4 to 6 weeks. After this period of time, transform foci develop. These are transformed cells essentially pile up upon each other, whereas the normal cells, which are not transformed, will stay as a single one cell thick layer upon the surface of the plate. One can do this assay and also at the same time use the same kind of technique to count colonies and calculate the surviving fraction of cells. So one can look at the number of cells which are transformed and the number of cells which are killed within one assay. And if one plots both of these on a log linear plot with dose upon the x-axis, one can see that cellular transformation increases with dose up to about 400 centigray before falling off. This fall off is caused by the loss of cells due to cytotoxic effects. It's interesting to look at the incidence of leukemia in terms of deaths per 10,000 person years in the data for Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the dose response curve, again, for this group, looks very similar to the dose response curve for the cells in vitro. In other words, it increases up to about 3 to 4 gray or sieverts before falling off again. It should be said that this dose response curve may not be the same for solid cancers, which tend to increase with dose. These studies have been used also to calculate the relative frequency of transformation and mutations in specific genes relative to the killing event. And you can see that transformation is a relatively rare event, and a mutation of a specific gene is even rarer relative to cell killing. Of enormous interest as far as the public is concerned, as well as scientists, is just how carcinogenic radiation is and what is the relationship between dose and tumor formation. Most of the data here comes from Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors, but there is a lot of other data which is available coming from workers at nuclear test sites and the nuclear industry, as well as cancer in the early physicists, the lung cancer in the uranium miners, in particular from Czechoslovakia, bone tumors in radium dial painters, and also a large number of patients who were treated either for diagnostic purposes or for treatment purposes. In the early days, many patients were treated for ankylosing spondylitis, for enlarged thymus, for ringworm, and other very benign conditions. When one looks at the number of patients in these studies, it's clear that the ABOM survivors are by far the largest data set. What this means is that these people who were exposed to acute radiation will dominate any risk estimate data, which is a risk estimate analysis which is made. Clearly, people are looking to other sites in order to develop other data sets. Chernobyl might have been thought to be a good data set in terms of looking at radiation-induced cancers. 5 million people were exposed to greater than 8 millisieverts, with 600 emergency workers and 600,000 liquidators who went in to clean up the mess. Of these, tens received greater than 500 millisieverts, and 200,000 received 250 millisieverts. There were 28 acute radiation deaths, and 134 had acute radiation syndrome. However, when everyone looks at radiation-induced cancers, there certainly has been a large increase in thyroid papillary carcinomas. This has peaked after about 6 years, with 800 cases. There's a particularly aggressive form in children who are exposed at around the time of birth. But there has been no really huge increase in, for example, leukemias. One would have expected approximately 200 leukemias in the 3.7 million people exposed, and about 200 in the 200,000 liquidators. There are many predictions have been made in terms of the people in this area. Certainly, there are a large number that have been exposed to radiation. One group predicted that there might be 16,000 deaths from cancer. Which probably pales into insignificance in terms of the number of deaths as a result of tobacco smoking. However, obviously, this is something that really will need to be looked at, and no doubt in time will become available. One thing that is clear is that there are a lot of psychological effects within the population, which are very serious, and there are a lot of non-radiation related health problems. One thing that is going to be unclear for a considerable period of time is whether the risk for chronic radiation exposure is the same as for acute exposure, and is there a dose rate effect. The major site for investigating this issue is MIAC, which was the plutonium reactor site in Russia. There was, at the time, a big rush for the Russians to get A-bombs. And in order to accelerate progress, they didn't really care too much about the nuclear waste. They stored 4 × 10^18 becquerels in a nearby lake. They released 10^17 becquerels into the Tetchka River. There was a plant which was built in 1957. About 9 years after work started in the nuclear reactor, which was a chemical processing plant. Unfortunately, there was an explosion in the plant, and a plume of megacuries of radioisotopes was released, exposing over a quarter of a million people. So within this area, there were certainly hundreds of thousands of individuals who have been exposed, and tens of thousands have been exposed significantly. Again, there are chronic health problems in this area, some of them certainly caused by radiation, but there are no analysis in terms of a dose-response relationship. So we tend to rely largely upon the A-bomb survivor cohort to derive risk estimates. I should say that this data is really quite mature for the most part, and is also relatively solid. The latency for leukemia and lymphoma is 7 to 12 years. Solid tumors take considerably longer in order to occur. What this means is that in the survivors, the incidence of leukemia and lymphoma is now normal, whereas solid tumor incidence is still elevated. The analysis suggests that there were 76,000 survivors in Hiroshima and Nagasaki who had been exposed. About half of these had been exposed, about 42,000, in the sense that they received doses in excess of 5 millisieverts. Of those who were exposed, approximately 3,400 developed cancer between 1950 and 1985. This is the equivalent of 8.23%. If you compare that with the individuals who receive less than 5 millisieverts, you can see that about 7.3% of those develop cancers. So certainly there was an increase in cancer. The data has been worked and reworked over and over again by various groups. The variables that have been looked at are the age at the time of exposure, the dose rate to a certain extent, and the quality of the radiation. This has been used has been put into a model, and the model that is most consistent with all the data is a model that is a time-dependent relative risk model. What this means is that the risk increases by a constant factor at all ages. In other words, radiation doesn't appear to alter the timing of cancer, but what it does is it increases the odds on an individual developing cancer at a specific age. The dose response curve appears to have no threshold, although it's very difficult to decide that. It's taken to be a linear dose response curve. Excess cancers are a function of dose squared, age at the time of exposure, and the time since exposure. The tissue is really valid only for leukemia or breast, the digestive system, and the respiratory tract, the other cancers being relatively small in number. One can see the effects of age of exposure in the breast cancer mortality group. The excess relative risk per gray is very much higher if individuals were exposed whenever they were 25 years old, as opposed to 45 or 65 years old. This data has been taken and used to advise upon the age at which women should start having mammography. In general, the risk estimates for radiation-induced cancer that were established are based upon looking at rather homogenized data, but it suggests that if 100,000 people were to receive 0.1 sieverts of whole body radiation, there would be about 800 deaths from radiation, with fairly tight 90% confidence limits. About 100 of these would be from leukemia. This should be put against the fact that there would be 18,000 deaths expected without radiation exposure. So a single exposure to 1 sievert is therefore associated with an excess death of about 8%. It's also been estimated that continuous exposure to 10 millisieverts per year would be associated with an excess mortality of about 5.6%. It's important to realize that with doses of less than about 400 millisieverts, there is no evidence for cancer induction, but at least in theory, any dose can be thought of as being carcinogenic. What this means is the risks at low dose have to be estimated from modelling at higher doses. This is still a very contentious issue, and there are many people who believe that low-dose radiation, in fact, has a hormetic effect or a positive effect upon health. To put these risk estimates into perspective, some studies have been done which have looked at the risk of radiation-induced cancer as compared to other risks that exist. For example, mammography at the age of 45 will give a lifetime risk of 5 extra deaths per million people treated, and so would a round trip to New York by air. The chest X-ray gives a dose of approximately 0.15 millisieverts, which is the same as smoking about 5 cigarettes or driving 50 miles. Of considerable significance, in addition to radiation carcinogenesis, is the effects of radiation exposure on the embryo and fetus. This can take a variety of different forms. One is prenatal or neonatal death, the occurrence of malformations, or growth abnormalities. Again, Russell and Russell were the major contributors in this area. They gave mice 2 gray at various times after fertilization and looked at the effect. What they showed was that if the irradiation was given very early on in the pre-implantation phase, there was a high incidence of prenatal deaths. On the other hand, if it was given 1 to 2 weeks post-conception, during the organogenesis phase, this was associated with increased abnormalities and cancer, and also neonatal deaths. This is the equivalent of 2 to 6 weeks post-conception in humans. Effects on the fetus were considerably less, however, than on the organogenesis phase. However, growth retardation was seen, as was an increase in malformations. The human studies are limited again to the A-bomb survivors, which show increased fetal and infant mortality, decreased growth rate. Interestingly, there's a high incidence of microcephaly and mental retardation. This is mainly in children who were 8 to 15 weeks post-conception at the time of irradiation, and with doses in excess of 0.1 sieverts. But after 1 sievert exposure, about 40% of them were mentally retarded, and it can be worked out that this was the equivalent of a 30 IQ point drop. There was a slight increase in cancer in children who were just born at the time of radiation, but not in those that were exposed in utero. There was also an increase in late cardiovascular effects, which still has to be properly analysed. The other human studies that are of interest come from the Oxford study of childhood cancers done by Stewart and others, which showed a 40% increased risk of cancers in individuals who were exposed to X-rays in utero. This risk was highest in individuals who were exposed to radiation during pregnancy in the 1940s. The reason for these exposures were diagnostic. Often people were looking to see whether there were twins or not. And in the 1940s, the X-ray machines gave fairly high doses of radiation in comparison with what they do today. And certainly the relative risk from exposures was in the order of about 2. In general, medical exposures are thought to lead possibly to abortion with few abnormalities if it occurs within the first 2 weeks after conception, with peak abnormalities occurring at 4 to 8 weeks. And abnormalities including mental retardation at 11 to 16 weeks and also stunted growth. All this has led to limits on occupational exposure, with maximum permissible dose being 0.5 millisieverts per month for pregnant women to a maximum of 5 millisieverts. Patients are generally thought are advised to consider abortion if they're exposed to greater than 100 millisieverts during the period of 10 days to 26 weeks. So it's possible, therefore, to use largely the Hiroshima and Nagasaki data to work out radiation-induced stochastic low-dose effects and the risks that are associated with exposures. These risks are generally fairly modest in comparison with the risk, for example, of giving birth to an abnormal child, which is relatively high, or the risk of developing cancer when 1 in 4 of the population are doing this anyway. These risk estimates, as I said earlier, have been put into a more societal framework. A 1 in a million risk is considered to be inherent in travelling 1,000 miles by air, with 17% of that risk being due to radiation, and about 83% being due to an accident. 100 miles by car, 10 miles by bike, smoking one cigarette, 2 days of living in Los Angeles, 20 minutes of being 60-year-old. All of this is equivalent to exposure to 0.1 millisievert. There are many things that are bad for you. For example, smoking will give rise to a considerable loss of life, as will obesity. In comparison with that, occupational ionizing radiation exposure is a relatively small risk. In spite of the fact of this fact, it is a very, very highly regulated industry, with many, many advisory bodies, dose limit advisory bodies, regulatory bodies taking part. One should always remember at the basis of this is risk estimates are worked out upon an average individual. There is no such thing as an average individual. There are many familiar cancer genes which we discussed in another lecture, which are related in particular to DNA repair pathways. People who carry these pathways or these genes in a mutated form may be particularly at risk for radiation-induced cancers, and therefore there probably is a subpopulation of individuals who are likely to carry most of this risk. In general, although these risks are probably even for this population relatively low, there certainly is true that radiation is a carcinogen and it causes many harmful effects, and therefore all radiation exposures should be governed by the ALARA law as low as reasonably achievable.